know where I'm going, and I know who's going with me. I know who I love, but the here knows who I'll marry. I have stockings of silk, shoes of fine green leather, comb to buckle my hair, and a ring for every finger, feather beds are soft, painted rooms are bonny, but I would leave them all for my handsome, winsome Johnny. Some say he's bad, but I say he's bonny, finest of them all. My handsome, winsome Johnny, well, I know where I'm going, and I know who's going with me. I know who I love, but the year knows who I'll marry. I'm Chuck Gregory. This is the new American Dream Radio Show, and we are streaming live on Revolution Radio at freedomslips.com. It's listener-supported radio, so head on over to freedomslips.com or revolution.radio. Find that donation button and use it. Give them some love. Give them some support. I'm proud now to introduce my friend and co-host, Mike Palachek, an American writer.
Hello, Chuck. Tonight we welcome as our special guests M.K. Davis, Richard Flamer, Frank Cordero, Jim Fetzer, Philip Ferruccio, Larry Pinkney, Thomas Wortman, and Anthony Rayson. And as you might have, if you were listening last week, you would see that our show was abbreviated because Chuck's internet went up to combine the guests from last week with the guests of this week. And so this Thursday evening, we are gathering for the New American Dream Radio Show in Fort Lauderdale, in Port Orange, in Des Moines, Iowa, in northern Minnesota, in Madison, Wisconsin, in Cleveland, Ohio, in San Cristobal de las Casas, Chiapas, Mexico, in Minneapolis, in Chicago, in Benton, Mississippi, and wherever you are.
And our first guest of the evening is Philip Ferruccio, who joins us each week from Port Orange, Florida. You can find Phil's columns all over the internet. Just search for Philip Ferruccio. That's F-A-R-R-U-G-G-I-O. And so here we go with Philip Ferruccio, and it's the Empire, stupid.
Good evening, Working Stips. Full Metal Empire, a must-see film from 1987, is Stanley Kubrick's Full Metal Jacket. This film follows a group of young Marines from Paris Island boot camp right smack dab into the shit that the GIs called Vietnam. There are literally countless scenes that depict what our young men both felt and experienced during their tour of bullshit duty. This was our corrupt and perverted empire when the veil of deception and propaganda was lifted as Kubrick succeeded in revealing to us. One scene in the film that captures the utter depravity of our empire and what it did to young men transported to that once tranquil place, made sorry by our presence there. This was a scene inside the helicopter that was carrying Private Joker and his companion, the photographer, deeper into the shit. The door gunner was in the midst of executing civilians with his machine gun as the chopper flew on. Door gunner. Get some. Yeah. Anyone who runs is VC. Anyone who stands still is a well-disciplined VC. You guys ought to do a story about me sometime. Why should we do a story about you? Because I'm so fucking good. I done got me 157 dead gooks killed, plus 50 water buffalo, too. Them's all confirmed. Any women and children? Sometimes. Well, how can you shoot women and children? Easy. You just don't lead them on so much. Ain't war hell? This writer has told many times of the guys from my Brooklyn neighborhood who never came home alive. There was Vito, the Polish-born son of my friend's building superintendent. Vito joined up and became a ranger, replete with the beret and high boots. I can still see him standing there in the back of our church, right next to me at Mass one Sunday when he was on leave. He didn't remember me, so all I could view was Vito's lean figure holding that beret as we all prayed together. He looked straight ahead during the whole Mass. The key word here would be gallant, as he genuflected and exited church. I never saw him again alive, nor did his family, as Vito was killed on some made-famous hill in Vietnam. His kid brother, 2 years younger than me, really took Vito's death hard. A few years later, I would see the kid, now 18 years of age, in a hidden corner of the schoolyard on many afternoons, sniffing glue. I then heard that he had dropped out of high school. Soon after, I got the word that he was now shooting up heroin, and not in the schoolyard. A year or so later, I got the news that the kid had OD'd and was dead. Another guy from my neighborhood was Tommy L., the son of our church's school crossing guard. You cannot forget her, Mrs. L. She always would have that tremendous smile across her face. She would greet everyone who crossed Ocean Avenue from Sunday Mass with her almost contagious joy. In 1968, her son Tommy joined the Marines along with his buddy Pete Harrows of the Harrows Coffee Shop family. Pete came home a year later, but Tommy's tour was cut short due to his death in some anonymous rice paddy. The extra tragedy was seeing this wonderful woman at her post each Sunday with what I always remembered as this Mona Lisa smile. It was how I always interpreted Mona Lisa from the famous painting. She had that look, that smirk, holding back her smile as if saying, "Oh, if you only knew what I'm going through." The rear gunner for Full Metal Jacket actually captured what Vito and Tommy's families would say in that eight war hell. One surmises that this is what the families of all our young men in uniform would say when their loved ones were either maimed or killed in Iraq and Afghanistan. What should they say to men like Elliot Abrams and John Bolton? The Vietnam War was sure as shit not hell to those two. You see, both of them were born in 1948, so they could have, or should have, if they were true believers, served in the shit. Abrams graduated Harvard and practiced law and never signed up to fight the commies in Asia. He just became a neocon couch warrior and worked in the Reagan and Bush senior administrations to support every illegal and immoral phony war, along with Latin American covert actions. Bolton graduated Yale before his draft number was pulled. He took the best get out of Vietnam card, which was to join the Maryland National Guard. Why was that the best way to avoid going to the shit? Well, you can ask both Poppy Bush and his son W about that. They knew that getting into the Guard was a sure-ticked way to not being sent overseas. Because at that time, unlike nowadays, the Guard and Reserves would be the last to be sent overseas to fight and die. They were safe. So what do most chicken hawks become? Well, war criminals or those who serve such men and women? Just look at Condi Rice of the infamous smoking gun could be the mushroom cloud fame. Since evil has a tendency to recycle itself, Abrams and Bolton are center stage and ready to initiate regime change in Venezuela and Iran. Imagine all those diehard Trump supporters, the ones who still have their doubts about the Iraq war, as Trump keeps on saying he does, and how they are now looking down the rabbit hole of more foreign interventions, the ones that candidate Trump railed against, but never followed up on. As the Catholics would say, it is a mortal sin for any government to have these two predators on their payroll, let alone as key advisors. Now, regardless of who sits in that situation room and is called commander-in-chief, they are all pawns of this empire. Clinton with Yugoslavia, Bush Jr., Iraq and Afghanistan, Obama, Libya and Syria, and now Trump. Eight war hell. Thank you.
Our next guest to the show is Jim Fetzer. Jim Fetzer lives in Madison, Wisconsin. He's a retired professor. He's a researcher, a radio show host, and we're lucky to hear Jim every month. And now we're going to listen to Jim Fetzer in Madison, Wisconsin.
Mike, Chuck, great to be back with you again. It's crunch time in the Sandy Hook Posner versus Fetzer lawsuit because the defendant's opportunity to submit motions for summary judgment came on that last day of April. And I submitted such a motion, as did the plaintiff, to wit the attorneys representing Leonard Posner, who is one of the fake Sandy Hook parents who's been cashing in, making, you know, between $1 and $5 million just off of the donations that were contributed by sympathetic but gullible Americans in the false belief that these parents had lost children at Sandy Hook, or that other families had lost teachers and the principal and even the school psychiatrist. But since we established in the book nobody died at Sandy Hook, that the school had been closed by 2008, that there were no students there, where we have even obtained the FEMA manual for a drill, a mass casualty exercise involving children conducted on the 13th, beginning at 8 a.m. and it'll ending at 11:59 a.m., where you can find the manual as Appendix A in the book, which when Amazon banned it on 19 November 2015, after having gone on sale on October 22nd and sold nearly 500 copies, I released it for free. So you can download it at your pleasure for your own desktop. Now, you'll find on my blog at jamesfetzer.org, Sandy Hook Posner versus Fetzer lawsuit, defendant's motion for summary judgment. You can find the whole case, where what I presented was a focus evidence related to the two death certificates that are the central issue here. A death certificate identified as Exhibit A, which was attached to the complaint when I was sued by Leonard Posner on the 29th of November, which is a state certified death certificate, or so they maintain, and Exhibit B, which is the death certificate that Lenny gave to Kelly Watt, which she and I discussed in Chapter 11. You can find it there in the free book you can download, where I've made quite a number of rather important points about the death certificates, where they have argued that since there is this state-certified death certificate, and they claim, which differs in no material respect from the one that I have criticized as being a fake, a forgery, and a fraud, that therefore I have committed defamation, to which I have replied that since we've already demonstrated that the death certificate that Lenny gave to Kelly, to wit Exhibit B, is a fabrication, if indeed it does differ in no material respect from Exhibit A, the state certified, then the state has certified a fabricated death certificate, which is a crime. Now, in my motion for summary judgment, I make a half a dozen points about the state of the death certificates. The first, because Exhibit B, which is the death certificate that Lenny gave to Kelly, is uncertified, it is a fake. In fact, there are rather strict state laws that regulate these matters. There were many obvious indications something was wrong here, including that it had no file number, that it had the wrong estimated time of death at 11 a.m. when the shooting officially took place between 9:30 and 9:40 a.m., that the texture The bottom half or two-thirds even was very dark compared to the top one-third, which led me to infer that it appeared to be the combination of the bottom portion of a real death certificate with the top half of a fake. There are various other typographical anomalies I also mentioned, but where these are among the reasons for my concluding that Exhibit B, which was the one I was discussing in the book, was a fabrication. The second point we make is Exhibit B says no autopsy was performed, yet the plaintiff has submitted an autopsy report to the court. This is among the most interesting aspects of the case, where no doubt there will be more to come, and where we will have the opportunity, by the way, they to respond to my motion for summary judgment, me to have my opportunity to respond to theirs, and we have a whole lot more evidence in support of our case that we will deliver at the appropriate time. In any case, actually, both Exhibit A and Exhibit B claim that no autopsy was performed when the plaintiff has submitted an autopsy report. So it also impugns the state certified death certificate as well. Here's another point. Third, the 26 December 2012 date of the town registrar's receipt of the death certificate on both Exhibit A and Exhibit B is not legally compliant, meaning the child was buried without a permit and that both death certificates are fake. In other words, here we have another reason. The Newtown Registrar, Debbie Aurelia, wrote that she obtained the death certificate 26 December 2012, which violates the Connecticut law, which provides a funeral director must complete and file a death certificate no more than 5 business days after death. Remember, this was allegedly taking place the shooting on the 14th of December, so the 26th is around 12 days, depending how you count it, not the 26th, when Noah was reported to have been buried on the 17th. Thus, the death certificate wasn't registered as of 17 December 2012, and therefore there could not have been a burial permit when the boy, to whom the plaintiff oddly refers to as N.P., merely by his initials. In addition, the time of death, as I've in fact already mentioned, does not comport with the official narrative, and no declaration of death was made at that time or ever. This is extremely interesting, because the plaintiffs have maintained that the death was declared by an EMT, and yet we have a statement from an EMT that Karen Halstead, a captain at the fire department, saying neither she nor any of her crew, the search and rescue team, went inside at Sandy Hook Elementary School on 14 December 2012, which means that no paramedic ever declared anyone dead inside the school. This is Exhibit D here in my enclosures. This is pretty fascinating, too. Moreover, in addition, Exhibit A is not a certified copy since it's illegible and bears no raised seal. This is a copy that was actually attached to the complaint. I have indeed subsequently obtained a copy directly from the state, which happens to have a raised seal and is far more legible. So it's really quite perverse, it seems to me, that I was served with a complaint that had a virtually illegible death certificate, even though that was the core of the plaintiff's case. Six, both exhibits display topographical inconsistencies suggesting they are both fake, which I've repeated on several occasions. Now, the argument in support of my motion for summary judgment, which would give me a victory without the necessity of having to take the case to trial, because there are no facts in dispute that would be required for the jury to resolve, my statements were substantially true, so the claim of defamation cannot stand. In order to be guilty of defamation, you must have been making false claims, where truth is an absolute defense. But since my statements were true, the requirement is only substantially true, meaning you could have made minor mistakes. But the claim, that means the claim of defamation cannot stand. Moreover, I mean, no statements about Exhibit A, which is a state-certified death certificate, which means the element of publication by having published, which is necessary in order to have a finding of defamation against me. And moreover, third, defendant's statements are privileged under the First Amendment since a plaintiff, Leonard Posner, is a limited purpose public figure, which means the standard is actually actual malice. Then I knew what I said was false, but I went ahead and made it, asserted it anyway with the intent to defame the plaintiff in this instance, which was not the case. My many iterations and the evidence I've adduced have substantiated my position as sincere. And since it's evident he's a limited purpose public figure, I believe that a motion for summary judgment is going to carry the day. Check it out on my blog. And no doubt next opportunity I have to join Chuck and Mike, I'll give you a further update about the state of the Sandy Hook Posner versus Fetzer lawsuit. Where Sarah Westall, by the way, has done a two-part interview with me you can find on BitChute, Posner versus Fetzer, Why the First Amendment Right is at Stake. It's simply excellent. She even has an intro on YouTube about the case, which YouTube, to this point in time, has not taken down. Chuck, Mike, thanks for having me here. It's always a pleasure.
Coming up in the next half hour, we'll hear from Frank Cordero in Des Moines, Anthony Racin in Chicago, and Larry Pinkney in Minneapolis. Please stay tuned to Revolution Radio, the listener-sponsored alternative to the lies presented elsewhere, day in and day out.
Some comfort at Willow's World. A variety of news, commentary, and poetry at Willow's Poetry Corner, where there are comfy cushions and a tempting selection of delectable comestibles. A show that's quirkily and quintessentially British, with a unique twist featuring Willow Andreasen, your host. Join Willow Mondays and Thursdays, 2 till 4 p.m. Eastern Time, Studio A.
Travels to Earth through the rainbow crystal bubbles from the furthest reaches of space and time, across the dimensions, through the elements, and in harmony with the colors of the universe. Through her mastery of abstract stream of consciousness malapropisms, she weaves a web of comic, satiric, cosmic conversation. Her subjects can range from Norman, the goose next door, to astrology and earth changes, and into the deep recesses of the soul matrix. She holds a wealth of knowledge on herbs, plants, and astrology. Join Mona and her guests on Adventures of a Feral Hippie as she touches the earthly radio waves 5 days a week at 2 p.m. Monday to Friday on Studio B at Revolution Radio.
Extend your life with Extendovite.
When your doctor tells you you have bad cholesterol or blockages in the arteries, what do you do? When diet and exercise is not enough, we try medications and hope for the best. For the last two decades, I have been telling people about a natural method to help solve these problems and more. Extendivite can help maintain cardiovascular health and lower blood lipid levels in adults. The seven herbs in Extendivite are known to work together synergistically to get the results we hope for. There are many testimonials on Extendivite's effect on circulatory-related ailments. Get Extendivite today to start your journey back to a healthier life. To order, call 1-877-928-8822 or visit heartdrop.com or see us on amazon.com.
Extend your life with Extendivite.
The opinions expressed on this radio station, its programs, and its website by the hosts, guests, and call-in listeners or chatters are solely the opinions of the original source who expressed them. They do not necessarily represent the opinions of Revolution Radio and FreedomSlips.com, its staff, or affiliates.
You're listening to Revolution Radio, FreedomSlips.com, 100% listener-supported radio, and now we return you to your host.
Our next guest of the show is Frank Cordero. Frank Cordero, as always, joins us from the Des Moines Catholic Worker in Des Moines, Iowa. And now a conversation between Frank Cordero and Chuck Gregory.
Hello, Chuck.
Well, hello, Frank.
How you doing?
I'm good.
Well, another week.
It sure is.
I just have to go downstairs and let folks know what I'm doing. Hold on.
Okay. Sure.
Maybe you hear me chomping down the stairs here. Still, I'm going to be on this radio talk show, weekly thing, doing. I'll be back 10 minutes. All right. We're a little short on people, so I want to check in. As I go back up the back stairs, so I can talk to you. And the news here is that we have a Des Moines Catholic worker, Ruth Hart, who is en route and soon to be with the crowd in Washington, D.C., who are trying to occupy for the Venezuelan government their embassy with the notables of the Vets for Peace and Code Pink. And word's getting back that people have been arrested and the people who are in the embassy are being treated badly by the security people who are putting them under lights and noise, you know, loud music all the time. And they've been letting the police, the D.C. federal police, have been letting the pro coup leaders, their people, their street people, free to harass people in the building, threaten them, beat them up, and they let them do it, all the while arresting anyone trying to get food to the people in the embassy, the Americans in the embassy. So we have this very extraordinary moment that the Trump administration seems to want to provoke the Venezuelans to do an act of war, to give them an excuse for military intervention. And the Venezuelans who were in the embassy gave their embassy over to these peace groups and said, you're our representatives. And should these thug Venezuelan pro-coup people get occupied and kick the Americans out, and the police let that happen, fully acknowledge that the Americans have the full permission of the existing Venezuelan government to be there, that would be called an act of war by the Venezuelans, and they, in turn, would be duty-bound to take over the U.S. embassy, which would also be an act of war. So we're talking about a tripwire here for military intervention that's ironically being acted out by the Americans who are occupying the Venezuelan embassy are the good guys. And the ones intervening on the Venezuelan embassy are Venezuelans who are part of the coup. It's crazy, isn't it?
It is convoluted,
It's Trump world, baby. Upside down. It is so crazy. Yeah. So we just that just happened. So we'll all take a number of extra shifts and listen to what's happening to our friend Ruth, who's going to get us the information back to us on a daily basis. So, but you probably can get this information. I mean, Code Pink, Vets for Peace. Pay attention. Everybody pay attention to what's going on in D.C., Bull, because it's really important.
Yes, it is. I have been following that, and I'm glad that you're going to have an inside person, as it were.
Well,
at least somebody on site. Yeah.
For at least in my world, at the one Catholic worker, this is what we live for. So we are wealthy people here who have enough wealth that our little collective can send somebody now to be part of this history-making thing.
Yeah.
And this is what we do. Most people can't get away. We can figure out how to get somebody away. When we're up and running like we should be, and I think right now we're doing okay, these are the things we can do. This is what the wealth of a collective living at a shelter below the poverty line allows us to do. Yeah, it's terrific. It really is.
Well, I will be looking forward to updates from that next week.
You got it.
All right.
All right. All right.
Thanks so much.
I talked too much last week, so we'll give you a few minutes off. God bless you. All right, Chuck.
Okay.
All
right. we always love to hear you. Bye-bye, Frank.
Great. All right. Bye.
Our next guest of the show is Anthony Rayson. Anthony Rayson joins us from Chicago. Anthony, of course, is a retired toll booth operator on the Chicago freeways, and he is a zine publisher. He publishes the writings of prisoners and others, and he publishes them, sends them around, and sends them back into the prisons. And now we're going to talk to or hear the conversation between Anthony Rayson in Chicago and Chuck Gregory in Fort Lauderdale.
Okay. Well, tonight, Casey and I, or tomorrow night, I guess, it's tomorrow night. Casey and I and two or three other people are going to be on a panel at DePaul as part of the Chicago Zine Fest. They're going to come to DePaul, and we're going to look at our archives, which half of it, of which is mine, I would assume, and then have a roundtable discussion and panel. So that's interesting. Anyway, so the topic is how are zines used in activism? Well, I would like to have you hear from the people I work mostly with, which is prisoners, and let them tell you why it's important to them. It's also very important to use outside and grassroots activism as sort of a different subject, a different way of going about it. But I feel that the voice of prisoners is all too few times heard. So I want you to hear some of what these folks have to say. Right, the first one's from Cornelius. He's a prisoner in Cameron, Missouri. He says, "Once again, thanks for all the knowledge you have bestowed on this young brother. Crazy growing up, I never had a role model or someone I can look up to. Every self-proclaimed OG or big homie I came across either us, you, or snaked you in the end. But I believe mistakes are the best teachers, which made me into the man that I am today. But I admire everything that you do and look up to you and all the authors and the pamphlets you've sent me. Funny, though, I've always been on my black power tip and the police tip. It wasn't until I began reading your pamphlets that I realized I was a black revolutionary. It's hard to come across young blacks in my generation, the 90s, who be on their black power tip, preaching unity among all and equal treatment. So it's good to come across brothers who share the same view as I do. Oh yeah, we tore this concentration camp up so bad they're closing it down in July. And it's supposed to be a maximum security camp. Another win for the people." Okay, so he just, I would say half the prisoners who receive material believe that I'm a black man, which I'm not. I may have a black soul, but so obviously this material goes across racial divides, and people can relate to it because it's the truth. All right, here's another little piece from Corey Lambert Lambing. He's in St. Petersburg, Florida. Says, I composed this letter to you today because my resistance practices have recently led to me going to the hole because I was using my knowledge of the law to assist others to get out of jail. And, you know, they can't stand that. Anyway, during my travels, it happened to lose a lot of my paperwork. And then one of them that was my most used and favorite, which was your exclusive CPR handbook. I support everything that you do and thank you for it. It is guys and girls like you that keep people like me motivated and sane and moving forward. Don't ever give up. I won't, bro. All right, here's an interesting piece by Rob Turner, who's an anarchist prisoner down in Reidsville, Georgia. He says, I got your letter last night about how you plan to include my letter during the May 16th DePaul panel discussion, or presentation, or hangout, or whatever it is exactly. I'm honored. More like California surfer lingo. Stoked, bro. I'm sure you'll conduct business, sir. The good kind, opposed to that capitalist-minded horseshit. I sent a letter home. Well, my mother's home last night telling me she can contact you at ABC Zine Distro. Let's see. Well, he goes on and talks about various things, but we're going to be working on a zine together soon, and that ought to be interesting. Okay, here's a piece, quick piece by a man named Charles Scruggs, who's out of Cumberland, Maryland. He says, my political education level has extremely risen thanks to the help of you guys, along with the help of my mentor, Mr. Amiri Guerrero. With the NCTT of Maryland and the effort I put into my studies, I'm really coming along fast. Well, that's good to hear. Here's another one from, and this is just little snippets from Eddie Holmes down in Jefferson City. He says, I was talking to one of my bros, and he said I should write you and see what all you are about and also request certain things from you and say hello. So that's what I'm doing now. I really do appreciate you and everyone for the struggle trying to uplift, guide, support, and aid and assist all of us brothers and sisters that currently confined, some going home and some that's not. And I appreciate it, and I'm sure they do too. Everything that you all do to help us out, educate us, and help make our time a little bit more easier. Well, that's part of it. It's also organizing. Okay, here's another one. By a fellow named Dion Crawford in Baraga, Michigan. I'm 28 years old. I've been held on this plantation for a few years now and have been sentenced to 25 to life. My eyes were opened to your zines a few years ago, 2015. And since that year day, I've been on a mission to wake our people up as well as any other oppressed individuals. Since coming to the penal, I've been searching for a true remedy that would help stop the cycle of my comrades in the streets, as well as the penal, the falling victim to the backwards thinking. I found the remedy when I started passing out copies of the zine, Kill Yourself, The Real Imperialist Policy on Gang Violence by Kevin Rashid Johnson, and Soledad Brothers by George Jackson. I used those zines to give my people a sense of a real struggle. Those zines spoke volumes on the subject, powerful. I am in search of true knowledge, wisdom, and understanding in creating change for our people and communities. It's my goal to wake up the deaf, dumb, and blind, young and old alike, to revolution in its different forms. I've been doing a lot of searching for knowledge and connecting to comrades that's facing the same trials and tribulations every day that I face. I'm Damu, and it's my effort to bring change for myself and comrades and revolutionize the street mentality. I just feel that we've been ignorant long enough and must break the cycle of causing oppression and destruction amongst ourselves and community. I want to build bridges with any comrade that want to create change for our people. Comrade AS, are you cordial with any of my comrades that would be willing to build on making change? My Damu comrades play an important role in creating change because reaching our lost comrades on the streets are most important to reach our youth, protect our elderly women and children. Cameron, I have 25 plus years of slavery in front of me, and I plan to use every single second to gain the proper knowledge to unite my comrades and create change. Like Comrade Rashid said, reverse the game and revolutionize Damu toward a clenched fist, red front alliance. Comrade Anthony, I ask for your help in educating me about the true history of the Damu and its true cause. So you see, the object is education and awareness and creating, helping people, what Malcolm X have taught us years and decades ago, that people need to understand themselves and learn what's in their soul and their history and what they're all about before they can really move politically. So we have a long way to go because there's been a lot of brainwashing and endless misinformation and non-information about the truth that people really need to learn. So that's why I focus on this serious political analysis. And every day I get letters like this and explaining why this particular medium and these efforts of me and other people are so important to them. So that's kind of what drives me too, is this reinforcement. So I know there is the real struggle going on, and I'm in part of it, although I may not be around people that often. I usually work alone, but that's how I'm effective. So I hope folks start getting into it more and learn more about what these unions are capable of doing, and how we can help those that don't understand things learn by working with brilliant thinkers who can put pen to paper and craft ideas that are powerful and effective and important to people, as well as artists who can draw powerful artwork to underscore these ideas. Is really the magic of communication and language. The written word will never die, or nor will the pen and paper. A lot of people don't have access to computers even today. And even if they do, it doesn't mean they're learning what they need to learn. They're getting sidetracked one way or another to get sucked into some kind of addiction or another, usually like video games or something. So this is where we can concentrate information and make it most useful for the people that need it. And that's what I put my nose to the grindstone to every single day to create this and write it, edit it, publish it, and most of all, most importantly, distribute it to those just craving it.
Thanks to Anthony Racin in Chicago.
The next guest of the show is Larry Pinkney. Larry Pinkney joins us each month from Minneapolis. Larry, of course, is a former member of the Black Panther Party in the 1960s. He is currently an activist, a radio commentator, a writer. And right now we're going to attempt to contact, in Minneapolis, Larry Pinkney.
Good evening, Larry Pinkney speaking.
Well, hello, Larry. It's Chuck and Mike, the New American Dream Radio Show, and you are on the air, and there's about 7 minutes left.
Okie doke. I'll be very brief. What I'm talking or like to address today is what I call killing the messenger while ignoring the message. I think it's very important for everyone in the United States and quite frankly around the world to pay close attention to what is happening and has been happening for some time to people. And this is, it didn't just start under President Trump. It went way back to Clinton, to Bush, to Obama, and it continues now. And that is the persecution of whistleblowers, people who are telling the truth and trying to get information out there for the benefit of us all. Unfortunately, the so-called, I call it the corporate stream, vomit stream news media, does not do this. For the most part, they are part of the same old system. So I want to be very specific about two people. One is Julian Assange of WikiLeaks, the other Chelsea Manning. It is, I strongly believe, that we should be strongly supporting both of these individuals for their contributions to truth-telling, speaking truth to power, putting it out there, the atrocities that were committed as against people in other countries. This is especially, and not just other countries, quite frankly, but right here. And Manning was very, very good at doing that, getting that information out there, exposing it. Assange, Julian Assange as the publisher, and of course as a journalist with WikiLeaks, also was very, 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 is very, very important. We need thousands of them, and we should be supporting them. Let us not kill the messenger to obscure the message. Pay attention, as they said in that old movie that I always refer to, The Wizard of Oz. Pay all attention to the man behind the curtain or the woman behind the curtain. So I said I was going to be brief. I ask everyone to please think about this. It's not about personalities here. We're beyond that, way beyond that. It's about the message. So having said that, I'm going to sign off, giving my love and respect to Chuck and Mike and to the audience of the New American Dream.
Well, Larry, thank you very much for that. And wow, that was very brief, even quicker than I expected. I totally agree with you about Assange and Manning. To me, they're heroes, or well, a hero and a heroine, I guess, is the correct terminology at the moment. But yeah, they speaking truth to power. Exactly so.
Very true. Very true. And thank you very much for giving me the opportunity. And I did want to be brief because I know other people also have things to say. So I just wanted to make my point and move on. And all power to the people. Thank you so much again.
Okay. Well, thank you again, Larry. And we will talk to you next month. Power to the people. Let's see. How's it go? Red, black, brown, black, or red. I got them mixed up. You do it.
Oh, doesn't matter. Black, white, brown, red, yellow. All of us together.
Thank you. All right. I love that saying, and usually I get it right. I actually, I've stolen it from you. I use it fairly often.
It's yours. Thank you. Looking forward to next month.
All right. Thanks again, Larry. We'll talk to you then.
Thank you, bro. Okay. Bye-bye.
And coming up in our next half hour, we will have Richard Flamer and M.K. Davis. So that's going to be very good.
Moonrock Books. We're a group of scholars, experts, and authors who feel the world really needs saving and that resisting the American Empire is the right thing to do. People are starved for truth. They are given lies. They subsist on lies, but it's not really living. People are not watching TV news. They're ceasing to read newspapers, too, because they know by now they will not find it there. The biggest battle being fought anywhere is with information. If the people can receive the truth, they will do the right thing. We are publishing the truth about Sandy Hook, about the Boston bombing, about the moon landings, about the Holocaust, and much, much more. The truth. It falls upon us to fight the empire and save the world. Join us, Moonrock Books.
Revolution Radio at freedomslips.com. We'll be right back after this message.
Hey, everyone. It's Barbara Jean Lindsay, the Cosmic Oracle. If you have questions about your past lives or future plans, need answers from the cosmos about your love life or career, or just want to keep your finger on the pulse of the planet, check out my show, The Cosmic Oracle, here on Revolution Radio at freedomslips.com.
It is no secret that the so-called mainstream media is best described as controlled propaganda. Countless news stories are either totally ignored or spun with half-truths, and because of this, essential facts and vital information are often compromised. Join Dr. Ott every Friday night on Studio B at 10 p.m. Eastern and learn why The Story Behind the Story was nominated for a Peabody Award in its second year of producing unparalleled broadcasting excellence in 1997. That is, if you really care about learning the truth.
Wadia will remain a dictatorship.
Or be quiet.
Why are you guys so anti-dictators? Imagine if America was a dictatorship.
You could let 1% of the people have all the nation's wealth.
You could help your rich friends get richer by cutting their taxes and bailing them out when they gamble and lose. You could ignore the needs of the poor for healthcare and education. Your media would appear free, but would secretly be controlled by one person and his family. You could wiretap phones. You could torture foreign prisoners. You could have rigged elections. You could lie about why you go to war. You could fill your prisons with one particular racial group, and no one would complain. You could use the media to scare the people into supporting policies that are against their interests.
Tune in Monday through Friday, 4 p.m. Eastern Time, for Liberation Nation with Deacon John, where America comes to hear the truth.
I know this is hard for you Americans to imagine, but please try.
Ohio Exopolitics will be on from 4 to 6 p.m. Eastern on Studio A. Mark Schneider will have guests on that will discuss many important topics, including the state of the world today. However, much of the show will be dedicated to the writings of Edward Albert Meyer. Let me read a short passage from one of his writings. Love is the highest principle of creation, and through it, everything exists in absolute logic. All of nature in its indescribable splendor is nothing but the love of creation, which is expressed visibly. The love of creation is everywhere, because without it, nothing at all would be able to exist. Please join Mark on Ohio Exopolitics from 4 to 6 p.m. Eastern on Studio A.
Extend your life with Extendovite.
When your doctor tells you you have bad cholesterol or blockages in the arteries, what do you do? When diet and exercise is not enough, we try medications and hope for the best. For the last two decades, I have been telling people about a natural method to help solve these problems and more. Extendivite can help maintain cardiovascular health and lower blood lipid levels in adults. The seven herbs in Extendivite are known to work together synergistically to get the results we hope for. There are many testimonials on Extendivite's effect on circulatory-related ailments. Get Extendivite today to start your journey back to a healthier life. To order, call 1-877-928-8822 or visit heartdrop.com or see us on amazon.com.
Extend your life with Extendivite.
The opinions expressed on this radio station, its programs, and its website by the hosts, guests, and call-in listeners or chatters are solely the opinions of the original source who expressed them. They do not necessarily represent the opinions of Revolution Radio and FreedomSlips.com, its staff, or affiliates. You're listening to Revolution Radio, FreedomSlips.com, 100% listener-supported radio, and now we return you to your host.
next guest of the show is Rich Flamer. Richard Flamer joins us each month for Catholic Worker in San Cristobal de las Casas, Chiapas, Mexico. And that Catholic Worker is an affiliate of the Des Moines Catholic Worker with Frank Carrillo. But right now we're going to listen to the conversation between Richard Flamer in Mexico and Chuck Gregory in Fort Lauderdale.
Chuck.
Richard, okay, it worked. Do you think we should pre-record?
Sure.
Okay, hang on. Let me turn this music down.
Okay.
Yeah, with it being this flaky, I think it's probably better we go ahead and do it now.
Yeah, just a minute. Give those to Chief, put them in the corral, and leave the rat to the chickens. Okay, I'm all set.
Okay,
I just putting the dog in the corral for the night.
One of them
tends to run away, and she can unfortunately jump the fence. So, yeah,
we had a dog that would jump the fence. He took his. Basically, he had three or four girl dogs that liked to follow him around. So he'd jump over. They'd all jump over the fence behind him, and they'd run around the neighborhood, and then animal control would show up, and they would all zoom right back and jump back into the yard.
Well, Cheech is sort of like that, although we don't have animal control here, but she jumps the fence and walks around, talks to the other dogs, and then comes back down to the gate and waits for me to open it up. So, but the only trouble is one of the other dogs tends to follow her, and that second dog is goes after chickens. And I've had to pay 200 pesos twice to replace chickens. So, but that's all right. I got them in the corral now, so we're all good.
Okay.
And this evening's talk's a little different than normal, but it's something that affected me this last couple of 2 weeks ago, and I thought it was kind of important. It's called the cat. I really disliked that cat, that feline that was mostly white with patches of black. The cat, whose name was Cat, shortly after she came into our family of four adopted dogs that my wife somehow encountered. One of the dogs, an Italian poodle, has symptoms of epilepsy, so was tortured by local children. Another rat terrier was one of a pair, but she was black in color, while her sister was white. The pair looked like an advertisement for scotch. The parents bought the pair for the child who mistreated the black one because of its color. The large Pyrenees grew too large for her Canadian owner. The last dog was from the same owner as Cat. Carlos was from El Paso, Texas. He built choppers for a living, mostly from old Hondas he rescued. He converted to Islam late in life, but was, as most converts I've met, very religious. In the Islamophobia after 9/11, he was held incommunicado by the police for several months, apparently for questioning. On his release, Carlos worked voluntarily for his mosque, traveling all over the Southwest, locating other members of his mosque held in detention centers, helping them in their eventual release. For his efforts, he was, for weeks at a time, held in detention for further questioning. After months of that treatment, he decided to move to Mexico to forego any further jail time. Cat was collected some 3 years back when she took up residence in my shop which is also a basement. She proved to be a great mouser, so we fed her. The only problem was that she ran away and hid every time my wife or our hired man came near. If I fed her, she would come to be caressed and petted. If I failed to pet the cat, she would howl, sometimes for as long as 10 minutes, even jumping up on the basement door. That cat was in love with only me, and I dislike cats. If I would sit on the stairs with her on my lap, she would quiet down after a few minutes of stroking. But then I had to suffer the wrath of my wife, who's allergic to cat hair. When Carlos moved to Mexico, he kept in contact by a computer with his son and his father. He set up a small business of selling crafts from local women in a cooperative near us. The money he made was deposited in a PayPal account from which he could withdraw as needed. When he moved to San Cristobal, he searched for some land outside of town where he could practice his religion and have some solitude. Cat did not venture from her basement space, occasionally ambling for the exterior door when it was opened. She would stare out the door for a few minutes, then walk to a safe place among the stacks of wood or under one of the benches. On occasion, the smaller dogs would come to the door and bark at the cat, but were barred from entering the shop. Whenever any other human entered the shop, the cat would scramble to hide. Carlos needed help in building his home in nearby Amatenango, where he'd found some land loaned to him by a Dutchman who grew flowers in an area of some acres. The flowers were grown in greenhouses, but there was no one living on the property to guard the buildings. The Dutchman bought the materials. I encountered Carlos when he came to me for advice in building. I helped him in his fenced area to build, and eventually we installed a solar-powered water heater and an inverter with other panels for his solar-powered electrical system. He began to grow his vegetables, continued with his business, and prayed his required prayers each day. He started collecting stray and abandoned animals. When my wife and I started driving north for a recent trip to the United States, the parents of Araceli came from southern Oaxaca to stay in the house. Parents are old and don't often get a chance to travel outside of their small town. While we were in the U.S., the parents, Anita and Virgilio, fed the animals and relaxed. 2 weeks into our trip, the cat decided to leave her subterranean room for the outdoors. She escaped and ran from the dogs to neighbor's land. Carlos ended up collecting, feeding, and caring for 6 cats, 16 dogs, and 4 horses. The horses had been hit by cars, so he nursed them back to health with the aid of a generous veterinarian. Some of the dogs had been injured as well. He healed them all. Some of the animals were pregnant, so he cared for the younger animals as well. With the help of his veterinarian friend, he had all the smaller animals neutered. The horses were the exception. He subsequently had 2 colts for his menagerie. As I write this, I can recall my early hours of today. I awoke to a cacophony of barking. 3 of the 4 dogs had something trapped under an outside sink. I pulled 2 of the dogs away and reached for the cat who had returned. Bad mistake on my part. Cat scratched and bit my hand, then fled when I dropped her. She went to hide under my truck, where 2 of the dogs dragged her out and killed her. A visiting immigration agent in Mexico, friendly with Carlos, came by his land to tell him Homeland Security had been inquiring about his presence in Mexico. The agent told Carlos in a few days he would have to come back and take him into custody. Around the same time frame, Carlos received a notice to appear at the U.S. Embassy in Mexico City, saying that his passport was invalid, hence he was in Mexico illegally. He asked me to help him flee, further declaring, "I just can't go back to jail again." I gathered money from the local U.S. friends of both he and I. The next day, I drove him to the Guatemalan-Mexican border and arranged with some local smugglers to get him on the other side of the border and on into Honduras. I promised Carlos I would try to place his animals in good homes. I spent 5 days returning to the homestead to move most of the dogs. One street dog, only a couple months old, came to our place. The same dog that led the killing of the cat. Horses were adopted by the Dutchman. On that fifth day, Santiago captured our cat, who would return for food, which we had put out each day. The other cats and kittens ran away into the nearby forest. For the following month, Santiago and I disassembled the house, cleaned up the site, continuing to put out food in hopes of collecting other cats and some of the dogs. No other cats returned. All while disassembling the house, I wondered about Carlos. I wondered why the government had continued to harass him 6 years after the 9/11 attack. In our talks, he told me that his imam had been deported back to Egypt. Members of his mosque, after their detention, had moved to various parts of the country, and some had fled the country, all for their religion. I wondered why I'd gotten involved. Not that I regret my role in his escape, and I would certainly do the same again. I really disliked that cat. For the last 2 years, I had to listen to the howling or spend time with the animal. Each time I sat on the stairs and caressed that cat, I wondered if Carlos had escaped. And where is he now? Has he begun his new life, still rescuing animals? A long time ago, when I was in Vietnam, I recorded indelibly in my mind the problems of civilians in a war. And I didn't know at the time, but have since concluded that I was probably on the wrong side of that war. The people of Vietnam that I met, so many of them were so kind and decent to me. And I often wonder about those friends that I had made while I was there. Did they survive the war? How are they doing now? And that cat was sort of a reminder of all of that. And tonight, I'm sitting here thinking about them all again and wondering, somehow, could I go back in time and stop that war or any other war? That's it for the evening.
Well... That was interesting, very interesting. You have such an interesting life, Richard.
Well, yeah, committing crimes, you know, take it being an accomplice.
Hey, that's all part of the job.
Yeah, it is all part of the job, and
that was a very brave thing to do.
No, not Brad. Right. It's one of those things where I always thought I ought to spend the rest of my life in atonement for my presence in Vietnam.
Yeah.
And that's the least I could do. But I just wonder where it all will end, you know?
Yeah.
When will the Islamophobia stop? Carlos was such a good man. He was just a decent man.
Wow.
And nobody's heard from none of his friends here, nor I. But I had suggested that he go to Nicaragua because the Nicaraguan government was issuing passports to whoever had been persecuted along the way. So I'm hoping that he went to Nicaragua and got himself a passport and got on with his life.
I hope so. I definitely do hope so. Wow.
So how are you doing?
Oh, pretty well. a lot of the same things as usual going on. My church, the rector of our church is leaving, retiring. So we have to pick a new one, and that's like about a 3-year process in the Episcopal Church.
Wow.
Fortunately, since I got elected to the vestry this year, I'll be part of the process. So,
good. An
interesting time.
Good, good, good. And please send my regards to Michael.
I most certainly will.
And it looks like I'll be heading up to the States in September again.
Okay.
I thought
you were done coming up here.
Yeah, I wish I was, but Araceli, we're trying to get her a permanent residency in the U.S.
Right.
And so I would have to go up and stay for a month or two and establish a U.S. address, isn't a problem, but means I have to go back up there and stay for a couple months. And then she'll have to stay there for a year to get a green card and a social security number and all that stuff.
Uh-huh.
But which means I'll end up going up again to visit, nothing else.
Sure.
So, but in the meantime, we have our life here, and I have my life here, and it's wonderful. I mean, it's just terrific. Living amongst the poor, and can't say as how I'd ask for a better life. It's great.
That's a pretty great thing right there.
Yeah. Call me again next month, and we'll try and explore these phone numbers, you know?
You bet. Thanks. Thanks so much, Richard. Talk to you next time.
Take care.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
Our next guest to the show is M.K. Davis. M.K. Davis joins us each month from Benton, Mississippi. M.K. is an expert in the Bigfoot phenomenon. He is an expert on the Patterson-Gimlin film. I'm not sure what he's going to talk about tonight, but it might be about that. We're going to try and contact right now M.K. Davis in Benton, Mississippi.
Hello.
Well, hello, M.K. It's Chuck and Mike, the New American Dream Radio Show, and you are on the air, and you have about 6.5 minutes.
Okay, well, I'm just going to talk a little bit about my recent trip to the Death Valley area. I went and I met some friends down there in a little town just over the border into Nevada called Beatty. Like Warren Beatty, the actor. It's kind of a famous little mining town. It's kind of quaint. It's got burros running wild, you know, from the days when mines were active all in the area. What we were doing going there, we were going to look for evidence of giants, which there's been reports that there were giants in the Death Valley area for hundreds and hundreds of years. So we were going to go down there and see if we could find anything on our own. And so I met up with several. It was Don Monroe and Joe Taylor, Ron Moorhead, and what's his name? Daniel Allen Jones. And of course now, Don is probably in his mid-80s. Ron is, you know, we were all kind of compromised in a way, in a lot of ways. We weren't young men, and Death Valley is very harsh. So we had to choose our goals, since this was, in April. And we went out into the valley the first day to look, Ron Moorhead and I, and it was 100 degrees. So the goal of getting across the valley and exploring an unexplored canyon on the other side, we kind of put that on a back burner, and we went after the other goals, which were more reachable. They involved areas that were not quite as hot They were up in the areas around the edges of the valley, you know, at higher altitudes. And they were canyons. And I knew where these canyons were. They were kind of hard to get to, but I had a Jeep, and we got fairly close and walked the rest. And we went up in there, and this one particular canyon, I'd been in it before, and I saw a very rare rattlesnake in there. And I went back in there this last time, and lo and behold, there was another one, a smaller one. And they're called the Panamint rattlers, and they only live right there in that area. So, you know, as far as finding a treasure or finding gold, if you were a person who was a biologist or a person who was a herpetologist, that would be gold for you. If you never found anything else, but we did. And so we made our way on up in this canyon, and we found a pack rat midden that was probably a couple of thousand years old in a cave. And if pack rats would take anything they can find, you know, and they would glue it into that midden using their saliva and bodily excretions, and they make a little glue. And this had done turned hard like a rock. So I know it was, you know, ancient. But inside that midden is samples of seeds and things that grew 1,000, 2,000, 3,000 years ago. So it has that scientific value. So I got a sample of it and brought it home. Another place that we went to was a place that Don Monroe and I had been, and it was an old shaft. When we, you know, we assumed it was a mining shaft, but it may not be. When we were there before, we found a ring of stones that were arranged in a circle out in front of the shaft. And they were so ancient that the sun had turned the stones to a dark brown, and you could look underneath and it was a light orange. So, you know, it had been become burnished by the sun. And I recognized the symbol to be an ancient symbol for God. You know, it wasn't a fire pit. It was too small for that. It was big stones, but in a tight circle. And it had a stone in the middle that was sticking straight up. So I knew that was a universal symbol for God. So when we came back this time and we finally located it, when we got over there to it, to go up to it, there was a big boulder, and on that boulder was a wafer, like you would eat if you were doing Catholic Mass, you know, like the body of Christ. And there were two bites out of the wafer, and it was placed on that boulder out in front of that promontory with that circle of rocks on it. So it it was sacred to somebody even now in present day. In present times, somebody had put that out there, and this was the day before Easter. So, when we left there, we answered a few questions, but we have a lot more questions that we would like to answer. And the significance of that place is one of them. So,
well, MK, thank you for that. It sounds like you found an altar out there. I don't know.
Yeah, something like that. Yeah.
Yeah. All right. Well, hey, thanks again. Sorry that it was a little shorter than usual, but we look forward to talking to you again next month.
All right. That's okay. Thank you, Chuck.
All right. Bye-bye.
Bye. Bye-bye. Thank you.
Revolution Radio at freedomslips.com. We'll be right back after this message.
Find some comfort at Willow's World. A variety of news, commentary, and poetry at Willow's Poetry Corner, where there are comfy cushions and a tempting selection of delectable comestibles. A show that's quirkily and quintessentially British, with a unique twist featuring Willow Andreasen, your host. Join Willow Mondays and Thursdays, 2 till 4 p.m. Eastern Time, Studio A.
Decentralization and bank annihilation. Bitcoin, Litecoin, MyCoin, YourCoin, blockchain, baby. Mondays at 1600 hours Eastern, Studio A.
When your doctor tells you you have bad cholesterol or blockages in the arteries, what do you do? When diet and exercise is not enough, we try medications and hope for the best. For the last two decades, I have been telling people about a natural method to help solve these problems and more. Extendivite can help maintain cardiovascular health and lower blood lipid levels in adults. The seven herbs in Extendivite are known to work together synergistically to get the results we hope for. There are many testimonials on Extendivite's effect on circulatory-related ailments. Get Extendivite today to start your journey back to a healthier life. To order, call 1-877-928-8822 or visit heartdrop.com or see us on amazon.com.
Extend your life with Extendivite.
The opinions expressed on this radio station, its programs, and its website by the hosts, guests, and call-in listeners or chatters are solely the opinions of the original source who expressed them. They do not necessarily represent the opinions of Revolution Radio and FreedomSlips.com, its staff, or affiliates.
You're listening to Revolution Radio, FreedomSlips.com, 100% listener-supported radio, and now we return you to your host.
Our next guest of the show is Thomas Wortman. Thomas Wortman is the executive director of the Ohio MUFON, Mutual UFO Network. And he joins us from Cleveland, Ohio. Right now we're going to attempt to contact Thomas Wortman in Cleveland.
Hello.
Well, hello, Thomas. It's Chuck and Mike and the new American Dream Radio Show, and you're on the air.
Great. Well, it's good to be on this week. And there's an interesting story that came out back around April 23rd. The government for some time has said that, you know, they haven't really been involved with investigations then of UFOs, and the Pentagon program that they ran came out where they spent $22 million. Well, recently, it was right around the end of April, Politico reported that the Navy announced that they're creating new guidelines for reporting UFOs. Now, they say that Navy pilots who think they've seen unidentified flying objects will now have a detailed means of reporting these unexplained events so the military can track what may or may not be happening. Now, it says the Navy's updating and formalizing this process by which the reports of such suspected incursions could be made to the proper authorities. Now it says a new message also is going out to the fleet that will detail the steps for reporting these. And it's in a draft form right now. The Navy doesn't think that
these are potentially alien craft, but they are saying that there have been a number of unauthorized or unidentified objects entering various military-controlled ranges and designated airspace in recent years. In a couple of episodes of your show, I talked about the Nimitz event back in 2004, where they reported objects entering the military airspace. These objects reported at 28,000 feet, going down to sea level and potentially even below the water, and returning back up to 28,000 feet. Initially, these objects are going at 100 miles an hour, but they went from 28,000 feet to sea level in 0.78 seconds. And this was tracked on radar. Well, it says right now, they've got a situation in which UAPs and UFOs are being treated as anomalies and really being ignored rather than explored. And the systems that they currently have in place basically dump that information when they see something like this. For example, they said if a military personnel sees an object on radar traveling at potentially like Mach 3, they're like, we don't have any aircraft going at Mach 3, so that can't be us. Or if they see something making unusual turns, unusual maneuvers. And they just kind of basically dump that information because they're kind of afraid to report it. Well, the new policy is going to standardize how these incidents reported and also what radar and other data may be gathered that the military can store for long-term and further analysis. And by the way, the incident involved with the Princeton back in 2004, with more witnesses have come out on that now stating that after the event, the data recorders were taken from the E-2 Hawkeyes within hours after they landed. And these are planes that had radar data from the event. Also, per crewman, the information regarding communications between the pilots and the ships also basically disappeared after that whole event. So somebody gathered that data, but they don't know who. Now, they said that the Pentagon has really intermittently funded these efforts, and they say in some of the articles that in 2012 they shuttered their programs, but that's not really true. Luis Elizondo, who ran the program, said it was still running when he left in 2017. And he came out and said basically he can't speak on behalf of the government, but he strongly implied that there's evidence that stopped him from ruling out the possibility that these are from alien, that these are alien aircraft visiting Earth. He said these aircraft, which he said, I'll call them aircraft, are displaying characteristics not currently within the U.S. inventory or any foreign inventory that he's aware of. These aircraft that's being reported, like the one off of the coast of California, had a tic-tac shape, and per one of the intercepting pilots and the radar operator, they said that the signatures did not match anything that we have. It had no wings. It had no visible means of, like, rudder and so forth to help make it turn. It was making incredible turns, and it wasn't just one. There were groups of five being seen at a time. And over a period of several days, they said there was potentially 20 different groups of five flying in that area, all making these same types of motions on air. And they didn't have any visible means of propulsion. Nothing was showing up on the FLIR cameras that identified any types of means of propulsion. So it didn't match anything in inventory. And it appears what the Navy is really getting serious about is saying, we don't know what these things are. They're not ours. We want to take and investigate these because what if they're from a foreign country? Just using an example of Russia. We want to find out what they have, what they are, and how they're doing this. But these events that they've primarily focused on have been off the coast of California, and also appears that the second one is off the coast of Virginia or Florida, much more recently in 2015. So this is a completely different stance on their Chuck. Regarding UFOs and what we've seen the military do over all the years.
And it's a really big step forward. Now, it doesn't mean they're going to be telling anybody, of course, what they're finding, but they are going to take and start collecting all this information and taking much more seriously. One of the pilots that was involved at the Nimitz event, he said when he landed, actually the guys had on tinfoil hats on board the ship, kind of picking on him about the whole incident. But now it looks like they're going to take it much more serious.
Well, that's very interesting, and thank you for that. I'm sorry we're having to cut you a little bit short tonight. Since we had to pull in people from two shows all into one, everybody got a little less time.
No problem. I completely understand.
Hey, we really appreciate having you on the show, and hey, talk to you next time.
That sounds great, Chuck. We'll talk to you then.
All right.
Okay, thank you.
Bye. Well, it's been another long week in Moon Rock Lake, Ohio, my hometown at the end of the empire. Once upon a time, there were these four guys who always had coffee together, and they were retired. After coffee, they didn't have much to do or think about. So they formed a band, man. Well, actually, they didn't form a band. But they came up with another idea to write a book. A superhero book about someone that would change the world, man. American the Beautiful. Written by four guys from Moon Rock Lake. To Bigfoot and to the aliens and to the misfits, the ones who do not fit, who do not know how to say their lines or even what their lines might be. We return now to our story. He stood on the curb getting out of jail after a long time. Nobody's there to meet him. He's thinking these thoughts and still nobody is there. He knows there will never be anyone there, ever. But he also knows all the guys are standing in the window in the unit watching him and waiting for him to be picked up by the black-haired girl. And, well, there is no black-haired girl, and he's waiting for them to get bored and leave the window. He really has no idea what to do. Up there in the unit, he knew what to do, or... Well, he figured it out eventually, but here on the street, it was the same old story. So he was just going to wait right here until he figured something out. In one hand, he clutched his cape, and in the other hand, his cap. Balanced on the curb on his heels, practiced how much of the rest of his foot he could put out there before he fell, and while he was doing that, he thought about that one story on the news where some scientist or something had found a way to restore hearing, and he thought maybe they were also working on a way to restore sight and taste. He put on the cap, and he wondered if they might find a way to restore wanting to live. That sense of joy that everybody, well, most everyone, well, no, probably everyone has as a child, the belief in the goodness of adults, man, woman, people, to wonder at nature and not want to destroy it, the sense that things will be all right just because. He let himself fall into the street and he sneaked a look over his shoulder up at the unit window. It was empty. He turned quickly, walked away fast. So, you think he just walks away? Yeah, he sure does. It's jail. He's getting out. He wants to get away from there as fast as he can, right? Yeah, I guess. Sure, that sounds about right. The four of them had the middle table by the window, looking out at the highway. Covered in notebooks, tablets, colored pencils, some crayons. They're writing a book, a comic book, maybe a children's book, maybe an important novel. They're just going to see where it goes. coffee group used to be bigger. A few years ago, they took up three, sometimes four tables. Always stayed too long. The gang was, there was Kenneth, Ed, Ray, Harry, Artie, Henry, Roy, and Howard, Leonard, Norman, Melvin, Clarence, Glenn, Bernard, Fred, Clifford. Ken died, so did Howie. Glenn got pissed. Clifford's in the nursing home, three blocks away. Norm moved to California. Ray got remarried, and his wife won't let him come most days. Roy and Leonard are Walmart greeters, so they're busy. Mel said he didn't want to do no book. Bernie just stopped coming. Freddie's been missing for 7 years. His wife and Lenny just threw a party to officially declare him legally dead. So now it's just Ed, Harry, Artie, and Clarence. They always sat at their regular table at Shirley's Cafe. They came here one morning and there were these crayons. What's this? Whose are these? Some kids left them there. Well, give them back. They were tourists, we think. Here, take them. We thought we'd leave them out. Somebody might want to do something with them. Ed pushed them to the wall. Well, and then one day, that's kind of how these four older men, well, not old, because what is old? You're 18 and you think you'll have done just about everything by the time you're 23. You're 63, you feel like you got your whole life ahead of you, even if you kind of wonder how you feel about that. These men came to be unlikely writers, artists, artistes in seed corn caps at a jaunty angle. Some kids left crayons there and comics, and you might imagine them sitting there with the adults and being bored out of their minds and screaming until somebody pulls out these crayons and paper, these bright colors and the possibility, and the drab world around them melts, molds, dissolves into a cacophony of Crayola cardboarding convalescence. They had nothing to do, nothing, and nobody was dying, not today, not this minute, and if that's the case, then you are alive. You're living. You have to fill the time with something, 24/7, 365, some damn thing. That's how it works. No matter if you might think that this should be over by now, the days just keep coming and coming like they will never stop, the faucet that just drip drips. And you can't sleep. Because you remember 30 and 50 years ago and that one thing and that one day like they were today. Not like you thought it would be, where you barely remember everything that's so long ago, or you just sit back and smile about all the good stuff. Not even close to like that. The past doesn't fade away. It shows up at your door at 2 and pounds. Anyway. So now it's just Ed, Harry, Artie, and Clarence. And why are they trying to create a cartoon book? A comic? Who knows? Maybe it's because that's what was here and they liked it. Maybe they're a more existential, counterintuitive, metaphysical, contrapuntal, quirkish reasons they have yet to realize. But one of them made a joke about how to use the crayons, and somebody else didn't think it was that funny, more like something they'd been waiting for someone to suggest to them their whole life. Who knows? Every morning, the cafe begins to buzz early. Shirley unlocks the kitchen side door, stamps her feet, knocking off a bit of the snow, hangs her coat, starts the coffee, the grill, greets the traditional first customers. Other workers begin to arrive. The coffee smell stakes its claim, and then the sausages. The impish cold sneaks across the floor at any opportunity, grabbing ankles, running up pant legs and dresses. On the street, the scraping plows turn back the snow for a moment, and the ring of the register marks the opening of the day. Ed's already there. It's his thing to get in the door without Shirley seeing him, and all of a sudden she looks and there he is. Anyway, that's how it started. Now she plays along not to notice him and sometimes make a big deal out of "Where did you come from?" which makes him smile. Ed sips his coffee, sits by the window, feeling the cushion of chili at the window. He hears, but not really, the sounds inside and outside as the other players in this daily performance take their places while the sizzle and steam erupt from behind the front counter like Old Faithful. From across the room, Ed looks like a Russian mobster waiting to do business in the export of saber-tooth pelts, all hat, coat, stumpy hands just barely making their way out the sleeves to envelop the white mud. "Sup?" "Artie," says Ed, as Artie claims his spot across the table, putting down the newspaper, then retracing his steps to hang his coat by the door. Harry and Clarence come in together by the north entrance and stop at the counter to grab cups from the tray. Music plays from the radio in the kitchen. "The ants are my friends. They're blowing in the wind," Harry sings. And "What?" says Clarence, at the same time that someone at a table makes a comment they don't really hear. "That's not a word." "Yeah, it is," says Harry. "Oh, my God," says Clarence under his breath. Not for the only time that day. Something he's noticed he's doing whenever something happens that really annoys him, and he realizes that there are a lot of those these days, more than before. Clarence wears a black and yellow veteran cap. Harry's is some sort of snowmobile company. Artie's is from a pro sports team. Sitting in their booth in the middle by the window, someone passing on the highway, headed to work in the dark, sees them day after day after day, year after year. Assuming they're sitting there in the light of the cafe with the street lamp outside, glistening on the snow like new fallen sugar, talking about basically nothing, doing nothing, thinking nothing, waiting to die, nothing more. And as that person looks away to confront whatever looms, like magic, supercalifragilisticexpialidocious, the table is covered in layers, paper, notepads, crayons, coffee cups, menus, gloves, with all the regular activity humming around them. If you look at Harry, his face, the eyes probably mostly, appears for some reason kind, intelligent. The hands give away 40-some years of manual labor, stained permanent with dirt, grease, and oil, and now with a layer of Crayola rainbow. Artie leans over the table with his elbows to converse in subcommittee with Ed on the subject of motivation of the main character. Why was he in jail? Did we ever figure that out? The others hear. Soon they're all in. Clarence, the carpenter, bricklayer, longtime high school custodian since retirement and volunteer fireman, orders food, pancakes mostly. Dad, the former city cop, clutches almost a whole box of Kleenex in one fist. That's a red nose. Artie, who can play guitar, piano, and harmonica, is also an accomplished home mechanic, former truck driver, and still drives a school bus route in the afternoon. He's the only one with a smartphone. The supplies stay behind the front counter. Usually Ed grabs everything in his arms when he comes in. They begin where they left off yesterday. "So," says Ed, "Kate?" superpowers? Why was he in jail? Said Ari. We don't know, said Clarence. Remember, we just thought that would be a good place to start. Well, yeah, but, said Harry, we need an origin story. What exactly is that? This is just something he's doing. Being in jail, it's not his origin story. Yeah, I'm afraid it is. Yeah, it is. It can't be. And that's the news from Moon Rock Lake. Where all the police and soldiers are thugs, all the Democrats and journalists are cowards, and all the Homeland Security COINTELPRO lone gunmen are about average. And that wraps up another episode of the New American Dream Radio Show. We had a little more of the guests and a little less of us this time, since we had things break on us last week. But I think it worked out really well. We are so lucky to have this great lineup of guests from all over the place. And I'd like to especially thank Mike, my co-host. Thank you, Mike, and good night.
Thanks for you, Chuck, for all you did to make it all happen. Thank you very much. And thanks to our guests, Thomas Wortman, Jim Fetzer, Richard Flamer, Anthony Racine, Larry Pinkney, M.K. Davis, Philip Ferruccio, and Frank Cordero. To contact the guests, you could, if you want, write to me at nwestiowa@gmail.com. Please visit the New American Dream website. You'll find information about all of our regular guests. Also, the show archives, newdream.us. Also, Penn Magazine, P-E-N-N, magazine.us. If you'd like to donate to the Des Moines Catholic Worker, write to the Phil Bergen House, 713 Indiana Avenue, Des Moines, Iowa, 50314. Donations can be sent to also to the Chiapas Project in care of Holy Family Catholic Church, 1715 Izzard Street, Omaha, Nebraska, 68102. And so good night to my friends, Chuck and Lorraine. Stay warm down there. Good night, Mrs. Calabash. Good night, Todd Beamer. Good night, Mark Bingham. Good night, Timothy McVeigh. Good night, Charlie Hebdo. Good night, Don Hawkstrom. Good night, Ken Lay. Good night, Muhammad Atta. Good night, Omar Mateen. Good night, Noah Posner. Good night, Crystal Campbell. And good night, Barbara Olson, wherever you are.
Oh, I marched to the Battle of New Orleans at the end of the early British War. The young land started growing, the young blood started flowing, but I ain't marching anymore. For I've killed my share of Indians in 1,000 different fights. I was there at the Little Big Horn. I heard many men lying, I saw many more dying, but I ain't marching anymore. It's always the old to lead us to the war. It's always the young to fall. Now look at all we've won with the saber and the gun. Tell me, is it worth it all? For I stole California from the Mexican land, fought in the bloody Civil War. Yes, I even killed my brother and so many others, and I ain't marching anymore. Thank you, everyone. Good night.
Welcome to Revolution Radio, where you, the listeners, are in charge. Here at Revolution Radio, we present 48 broadcast hours of news and information each and every day. Revolution Radio never sleeps. Revolution Radio is worldwide and borderless information. Revolution Radio is also commercial free. Revolution Radio is supported 100% by you, the listeners. And that's why we appeal to you to donate and support this station and its expenses. You can support us in many available options like archive subscriptions, our seed pack selections, or even my woodworking store. And we also even have Revolution Radio's swag. at the Revolution Radio Zazzle store, once you can get t-shirts, coffee cups, even a baby onesie. Or you can just plain donate to the cause. We cannot continue without your support, and your support is what helps pay the bills. So please, if you wish us to continue, please stop by our station support page and drop a dime on us. Revolution Radio, where information never sleeps. Safe? Do you have the necessary information to assist you in confidently living through just about any survival situation? Is survival and gardening, off-grid living, medical knowledge, or even natural or man-made EMPs on your list of personal concerns? Do you have your documents and your personal information in a safe place in your hands where you know where it is? Well, check out our preloaded EMP-proof thumb drive. Over 3 gigs of survival documents and how-tos, plus the USDA offline food preservation website, and much, much more, including a surprise bonus we just can't tell you about here. With plenty of room left over to store your most important documents, imagine if a megavirus or a computer failure took out your bank or all the banks.